Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As healthcare reform champion Ted Kennedy is remembered today, at least one group that's been critical of his hopes for healthcare reform is temporarily pausing its broadsides. Conservatives for Patients' Rights says it's suspending its advertising out of respect for the senator and his family. But other groups that oppose reform, such as Patients First, are continuing their cross-country bus tours. We had a member of Patients First on the program last week, and many of you wanted to know more about the group's legacy, pointing out that it's a creation of a larger group called Americans for Prosperity, which is funded by billionaire David Koch. So today, let's take a look at the lineage of protest groups and also take a look at their methods. We're going to hear from Democrat Bob Beckel, who says the town hall protests have been manufactured to disrupt meetings. Republican Cal Thomas says in return, they're just borrowing a page from longtime liberal protesters. We'll have that conversation. But first, who are these groups? Margaret Tolliv is with McClatchy Newspaper. She's in Washington. So start us off, Margaret. What is Patients First?
Well, Robin, Patients First and Patients United are both projects of a group called Americans for Prosperity. And when you see the bus roll into town, whatever town you live in, because they're all across America now, you'll see a big bus that says, hands off my health care.
Who's Americans for Prosperity?
Americans for Prosperity is a group that has existed long before the current health care debate and will exist afterwards. And they were started by David Koch of the Koch Industries oil family, and they are a conservative free market group that espouses positions on other subjects well beyond the immediate healthcare debate. The group's president is a gentleman named Tim Phillips, who is a former GOP staffer on the Hill who was involved with Ralph Reed in a variety of sort of professional grassroots causes, or opponents call it AstroTurf causes, under a group called Century Strategies, who were paid to develop support or opposition to causes largely by calling on Christian activists around the country. So Americans for Prosperity and Patients First are not just people with a shared cause in healthcare. They are professionals and investors and billionaires and folks with ideological bents who are involved in opposing big government or anti-free market causes.
And let's move to Conservatives for Patients' Rights. This is led by healthcare entrepreneur Rick Scott.
Yeah, this is a fascinating group. Its acronym, by the way, is CPR, so just in case you hadn't gotten that.
No, I didn't.
But Rick Scott is also a really interesting guy. He is a healthcare entrepreneur. He is co-founder of a group called Solantic, which is urgent care centers. You may see them in a Walmart or just standalone throughout Florida. But if Rick Scott's name sounds familiar, it may also be because he was the CEO of Columbia HCA Hospitals way back when, in the 1990s, at a time when they were being investigated and ultimately settled in a massive Medicare fraud case. And he has a lot of opinions and also a lot of money to back up his opinions and further his causes.
So I can assume with running something like Solantic, which appears in malls and other places and primarily treats, we understand, people without insurance, he may be against health care reform that's going to insure more Americans?
It's not quite that simple. He says that about 80% of the patients who come into Solantic clinics actually do have insurance, but many of the clients who they serve are uninsured or at least underinsured.
Let's move to FreedomWorks. This is the advocacy group run by former House Majority Leader Dick Armey. What role is that group playing?
Yes, well, FreedomWorks is not so much in the advertising business as they are in the advocacy business. And a huge part of what FreedomWorks is doing is the sort of earned media where you'll see Dick Armey all over TV talking about this cause. And also organizationally, they also are involved in rallying people who are for free market, small government causes and against anything that they consider a government takeover or increased spending.
Well, it's interesting. Dick Armey has denied any responsibility for the town hall protests, but drug firms don't see it that way. He had to quit his job with the lobbying firm DLA Piper because the firm's drug company clients, who collectively are represented by the industry group Pharma, complained that Dick Armey opposed health care reform. Now, these drug firms are pushing for reform because the more people are insured, the more people, presumably, who buy drugs. So, ironically, Dick Armey, who once lobbied for the drug firms, is now seen by them as being on the other side.
Yeah, a lot of the traditional sides that used to be able to predict who would be on which side of this debate have changed this year. And also, as you mentioned, Pharma has this side deal with Senate Democrats in the White House, which was touted, where they've committed to large sums of cost savings for seniors in the donut hole if there is a reform plan enacted. And in exchange, what PhRMA's members want is to know that the Medicare is not going to be negotiating down their rates or allowing reimportation from Canada. And so if you have clients who consider your behavior to be putting them in a tight spot, you know, when you take on a leading spokesperson role in a job like this, this is the big fight on Capitol Hill this year. And if some sort of reform or overhaul or whatever you want to call it passes, it'll have not only financial but policy implications for years to come.
Well, let's look at the pro-reform protest side. We have the group Healthcare for America Now for Reform. Who are they?
Healthcare for America Now is a huge umbrella group, and they're also a really interesting group. They claim more than 1,000 members, and it's everyone from ACORN, which the conservatives, you know, are complaining about, sort of community organizer groups, liberal groups, to unions, the NAACP, MoveOn.org. They get their funding from an interesting array of sources. A huge chunk of about a third of their $35 million budget comes from the Atlantic Philanthropies, which is an organization that's dedicated to healthcare and human rights type of stuff. But they also get about $500,000 each from each of the groups on its steering committee. And again, that includes groups like MoveOn.org and the SEIU.
SEIU, the Service Employees Union. You've written that SEIU has 400 staffers dedicated to healthcare reform.
That's right. They have an exceptional effort on the ground. And if you look at all the various groups, not just the standalone groups, but the coalitions that you've mentioned, Healthcare for America Now, Divided We Fail, I mean, SEIU has a hand in almost all of these groups. They have a huge interest, both ideologically and also in terms of their membership, in having something with a public component and expanded guarantees, you know, passed.
Well, do this for us, Margaret Olive. Compare the pro and the con protest sides. Do they have equal financing?
No. It appears, certainly at least at this point, as if these support groups have a huge advantage in terms of financing. I mean, you're talking about major powerhouses like PhRMA and the American Health Insurance Plans and SEIU. And on the opposition side, you're looking at largely small government free market groups whose founders may be millionaires or billionaires, but whose members are, you know, they're just like regular people. they're not as many of them in most cases.
Margaret, thank you so much. Margaret Olive of McClatchy Newspaper. So that's who the groups are. That's how they're funded. What about tactics and strategy? Joining us, conservative columnist Cal Thomas. Cal, are you there?
I am.
And liberal democratic strategist Bob Beckel. Bob, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Together, they are authors of the book Common Ground, How to Stop the Partisan War That's Destroying America. And they also recently wrote a column for USA Today on this topic. They join us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome to you both.
Thank you, Robin. Not only did we just write this column, we write it every other Thursday for the last 3.5 years.
There you go. You debate issues in a very gentlemanly way, which we hope we can maintain in the next few minutes. Because, Bob, you say that the shouting matches we've been seeing at town hall meetings are not just disruptive. They're Jerry Springer and Geraldo. They just shed no light. But, Cal, you say that's because people feel shut out. Tell us more.
Well, they do. I think, you know, despite talk radio and some of cable television and the rest, people don't feel that their government is responsive to them anymore. At least conservative people don't. They'll write their congressman or senator. They'll get back a computer-generated letter. They try to make their views known. They feel they're never taken seriously. And so then they go to these meetings, and of course they're organized. I mean, it's amusing to me to hear my friends on the left say, oh, look at that, they're all organized. The left virtually invented organization for these sorts of things, printing union-made placards, busing in people with free lunches and a few bucks in their pocket, even on voting day. I mean, this is a tried-and-true tactic. I don't mind them doing it, but I find it a little hypocritical when they say, oh, look, they're bringing in people. Well, these are American citizens who have a right to express themselves.
Well, Bob, you even admit to being the guy who organized people.
Yeah, I started this back in 85. I think there were probably two groups doing it, and it was a tactic directed specifically at town meetings for members of Congress who were home on summer recess.
Yeah, you were one of the first firms that specialized in packing meetings with voters.
That's correct.
So what's the difference?
I don't find any difference, and I'll tell you, I didn't think there's anything wrong with doing that. Look, these are citizens, and they got a right to be heard. My problem with it is this assumption that somehow people woke up some morning of a town meeting, and in this feeling of utter need to express their democratic views, they went down by themselves to these town meetings. Now, come on. You know, I was born tonight, but not last night. And the fact of the matter is, these people were organized. They went down there. They were given talking points. And if you notice, the news media did not take footage of people who were having a calm conversation. It's the old, if it bleeds, it leads. And the last thing I'd say is, I don't think these people showed up at the last town meeting. So this might have something to do with an organized effort to defeat health care reform.
So you say your complaint, Bob, with it is that it is manufactured democracy. But you also just said something interesting, that you have no question about their right to do this. And I'm wondering, because Cal, you know, brings up Code Pink, right, Cal? Medea Benjamin and others who disrupt congressional sessions with signs when they protest the war?
Sure, not only Code Pink, but this goes back to the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, which I used to cover as a reporter. I mean, this is the right to assemble and petition your government for a redress of grievances is in the Constitution. There's nothing wrong with this. Now, the point, though, that Bob and I make is, after the shouting and screaming and after you get all of this out of your system, have you really advanced the ball? Have you really had the kind of civil discussion that is liable to make an impact on your elected representative? And we don't think screaming and shouting and interrupting is the best way to actually affect policy.
Well, actually, I just want to ask you both, and Bob, you in particular, because yes, that's one point, that it's not maybe an effective way. But Bob, you also said it's absolutely their right. But isn't there a difference between protesting something that is real, say a war, and protesting something that isn't, like a death panel?
Well, yeah, of course there is, but let me make a point here. I used to do Crossfire for years, and I hosted with Lynn Cheney, as a matter of fact, Dick Cheney's wife. Crossfire was never meant to be a debating show. It was an organized shout fest. We knew that going in, and nobody in the end of a Crossfire show changed their position that they had when they went into it. These people who went down to protest the health care reform bill came there for that purpose, had no intention of listening to debate, and left with the same anti-health care reform feeling they had when they went in. Now, is that their right? Sure, it's their right. But look, let's keep in mind here, town meetings, and I'm from New England, have a long and storied tradition, and I used to go to them when I was a kid with my parents. I never heard people screaming and shouting. They didn't agree. They had a debate. In the end, they voted on the town budget, and that was what became the law of the town. Well, in this case, this is the law of the mob. Think about the poor voter who went to those town meetings with the crazy idea that maybe I could learn something. And look, I went up to one of those town meetings in Towson, Maryland, and I happened to see a number of talking points in the hands of people. Anybody who suggests for a minute that this is anything but an organized right-wing opposition to Obama is wrong.
Well, but Bob, I want to get back to the question that brings up, does everyone have the right to do the things on some of those talking point memos? One came from activist Bill McGuffey in Connecticut, telling people to shout down congressmen, literally shutting down the free speech of others at town hall meetings. Or Cal, use language like death panels. We've been speaking with conservative columnist Cal Thomas and Democratic strategist Bob Beckel. And when we come back, I want to ask you both about some of the methods, some of the tactics, some of the language. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with liberal Democratic strategist Bob Beckel and his longtime friend, conservative columnist Cal Thomas. They're talking about the tactics being used in the health care reform debate. And Bob, just before the break, you were agreeing with Cal that people have every right to protest. You think it should just be known when it's organized protest. But do they have the right to the language? Phrases like death panels, Nazis. Dick Armey of FreedomWorks told Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition today that he didn't know anyone using that kind of language. But what about North Carolina Congresswoman Virginia Fox, who said seniors would be put to death by their government? Or Senator Chuck Grassley at a town hall meeting in Iowa, who said you should not have a government program that determines if you're going to pull the plug on grandma. Cal, first of all, do you think it's fair to equate a voluntary counseling program with a death panel?
Look, I spent a lot of time in the UK. I spent a lot of time this summer there. I've seen the national health system up close. People have to wait for incredible lengths of time just to get a diagnosis.
Stay
an MRI.
With the death panel, Cal.
Well, I'm getting there. I'm getting okay. there, Robin. The point is, people see what is coming because they've seen this in other countries.
But people
now, you
live
don't have,
longer in Britain.
Have you seen their teeth? You don't have to call it a death panel, but when the government determines, and that's what we're talking about here, who gets treatment and who doesn't, based on a scale of age, how much taxes they're paying and this sort of thing, then it effectively becomes the government telling you who gets to live and who gets to die. Now, granted, death panel may be over the top in the minds of some, but the effect of it is the same. Someone else will decide whether you are going to get care if government is dispensing.
My dear conservative friend, there is not a single word in any of these bills, and I have read them all, and there is not one indication that somebody will put together a rank order of whether you live or die. This is simply...
Sure is. It's rationing.
No. Wait a second. It is a question of whether you want counseling on end-of-life decisions. And I will make this point. This has been introduced in other legislation for the last 4 years by Republicans.
Listen, if you want counseling, you can get it from your doctor. You can get it from your spouse. You can get it from your clergy person. You don't need a government bureaucrat counseling you. And by the way, if you're like 80 years old or something, what do you think the counseling is going to be if you're costing government more than you're putting in?
This will tell you how volatile this subject is. You and I have spent the last many years trying to find common ground and trying to spread the message of common ground, and we're having a hard time with this. I'll give you an example of this, though. Chuck Grassley, who supposedly is one of those people, the Gang of Six, looking for bipartisanship. The guy gets out to Iowa, and then all of a sudden a couple old ladies jump up in front of him. He loses his backbone completely. Chuck Grassley is no more of a bipartisan moderate as I am a Martian.
Well, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in there and just say, look, let's... Obviously, this is what happens when people try to talk about this, but you both have a plan, a suggestion
right.
for what could happen at town hall meetings. You say instead have a panel where a congressman might be questioned from someone from the left or the right in front of a town hall audience. But Bob, I'm surprised that you would agree to this, because the thing about the town hall, it's the Norman Rockwell painting of the farmer standing up, asking the question he wants to ask, whether or not the people to either side of him, his neighbors, have their arms crossed across their chest because they don't like his question. He gets to ask his question directly. Wouldn't a panel take away from that?
These town meetings are not a Norman Rockwell painting. They're a Charlie Manson sketch. Look, Cal came up with this idea, and I think it's a very smart idea in light of the environment that we're faced in. It's too bad we've gotten to that, but that's what we've gotten to.
Right. Well, the point is that people still can ask questions. They will be written down. They'll be submitted to the panelists, and people will be called on. And most people were brought up in a kind of environment where, you know, in school, wait until you're called on. Raise your hand. I mean, this is as American as anything else. The audience can still respond as it wishes with catcalls or no, I don't agree. But at least imposing some order instead of some open session with no ground rules would bring some order to the meeting and hopefully shed some light.
I'm going to have to close it at that, but the ground rules used to be you raised your hand, you got called on, and you talked.
It used to be. Yeah. That's the operable word, used to.
That's Democratic strategist Bob Beckel. We've also been speaking with conservative columnist Cal Thomas. Together, they're authors of the book Common Ground, How to Stop the Partisan War That is Destroying America, and they also join in a column for USA Today. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you, Robin. Well,
we took our annual trip out west last week to Utah. The Salt Lake Airport is so welcoming. All those people with signs, they're greeting returning Mormon missionaries, but they smile at us, too. Then nothing but road and radio.
Be still, my soul.
We also love to read local obituaries. Sherelle Timothy of Hurricane, Utah, passed last week. The death of her third husband left her so lonely she married her second all over again. Then hiking the switchbacks of Zion National Park's canyon walls, which rise straight up in the air like silent sentinels. Early Mormon pioneers thought they discovered God's country here and named it Little Zion. No matter what you believe, it feels sacred and humbling. We were surprised at just how dangerous the popular trail Angel's Landing is. A California woman fell to her death the week before, so we climbed the long spine along its thin, knife-edge ridge, a 1,200 or so foot drop on either side, clinging to chains driven into the rock like children along the neck of a stoic dog, joining complete strangers, helping each other. You can do it. Don't look down. Afterwards, we collapsed at the hotel just in time to see a woman on CNN at a town hall meeting compare Barack Obama to Hitler, and in turn, Congressman Barney Frank call her a dining room table. I had a couple of thoughts. One, Nazis in hiding must be high-fiving each other because genocide is being redefined as a benefits program. But also, Americans should be required to hike together. The only sound at Zion is silence and the occasional words of Americans urging each other to greater heights.
Be still, my soul. When shame and tears are past.
The group Eclipse, I heard them on Stephen Cap Perry's morning show on FM 100.3 Salt Lake City. Back after the very latest news, here and now.
Be still. Be still. Be still.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com. And the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A warning, this next segment may be too disturbing for young children. J.C. Lee Dugard was just a child herself, 11, when she was kidnapped from her bus stop in South Lake Tahoe, California. Now, after 18 years, she's been reunited with her mother. Her stepfather says she looks almost as young as when she disappeared and is feeling guilty for bonding with her captors, who police say are Philip and Nancy Garrido of Antioch, California. Philip Garrido is a registered sex offender with past rape convictions, and the couple is accused of kidnapping Dugard and holding her in a sort of camp compound in their backyard for 18 years, along with two children police say Philip Garrido fathered with Dugard. Robert Salonga of the Contra Costa Times joins us. Robert, first of all, do we know how J.C. Lee Dugard and her 11 and 15-year-old daughters are doing?
From what we understand, everybody's in good health, as much as you can expect for three people who spent generally the last 18 years living in seclusion in what can be described at best as campsite conditions, from what we understand.
Well, the whole story unfolded after Garrido took the two young girls to UC Berkeley to hand out some religious literature, and a police officer there thought something was wrong. What happened from there?
He had his two young daughters with him, and they wouldn't make eye contact with anybody, and that aroused suspicion, and that prompted police to run a background check, which turned up his status as a parolee. That led to his parole agent bringing him for questioning the next day. That was Wednesday, and it kind of unraveled from there. They were able to, under questioning, discover that he had kidnapped J.C. Lee Dugard and had been holding her for the last 18 years.
Well, people are wondering how this is possible. As you said, Garrido had been convicted separately from this case for rape. He was a registered sex offender in and out of prison for over the past three decades. And neighbors told you that he behaved erratically. We have a portion of a rambling 10-minute interview Garrido did with KCRA-TV from the county jail after he was held. Let's listen.
My life has been straightened out. Wait till you hear the story of what took place at this house. And you're going to be absolutely impressed. It's a disgusting thing that took place with me in the beginning. But I turned my life completely around. And having those two children, those two girls, they slept in my arms every single night from birth. And never did I have them. I never kissed them.
Robert Salonga, a neighbor, Damon Robinson, told you he called the sheriff's office 2 years ago when he saw these young girls in the backyard and thought it was strange. Nothing came of that visit. What are the questions being raised now? How could someone have parole officers and have a kidnapped victim and allegedly two children he fathered with her in the backyard?
For better or for worse, it's a testament to how well he was able to conceal this backyard compound of sheds and tents and outbuildings. If you enter the backyard, you would never know just from line of sight that there was something there.
You've been there. Tell us more about it.
There's a 6-foot-tall fence that was essentially concealing a backyard within a backyard. And so from line of sight, if you're just walking by, you're just going to see a normal backyard. It looks suspicious from aerial photos that a lot of folks have been looking at through Google Maps that there are these strange tarps. But, you know, as far as eluding detection, he was a model parolee. He re-registered as a sex offender every year, and he abided by the terms of parole.
Well, KCRA-TV also showed video of Garrido's car being loaded onto a tow truck, and many believe it's the same car that was used in the abduction. Now, we should say that J.C. Dugard's stepfather saw the abduction 18 years ago. He watched out a window, saw it, jumped on his mountain bike, tried to stop the car. There was a description of the car, and here it is sitting, allegedly, at Garrido's house. What questions are being raised about law enforcement here?
In hindsight, there are a lot of shortcomings that have been revealed, particularly with routine parole visits that didn't turn anything up. And so the veracity of those visits, I'd imagine, will be coming under scrutiny.
Well, what's next?
At this point, Mr. Garrido and his wife, Nancy, are scheduled to be arraigned in the case today. As far as J.C. and her children go, they're reunited with J.C.'s mother, Terry Probin. And from this point, how their reunion goes after 18 years of separation is anybody's guess.
That's Robert Salonga of the Contra Costa Times talking more about the disturbing case of J.C. Lee Dugard, who's been found after being kidnapped 18 years ago. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, mercury's been found in just about every fish in America. So when we come back, what to do? And what to do about the tuna, the bluefin tuna? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. A new government study found traces of mercury in every fish sampled in nearly 300 streams across the country. And mercury is rising in the oceans as well. Another survey from Harvard estimates that mercury levels in the ocean will rise by 50% in 40 years. Shark, tuna, and swordfish are particularly vulnerable to higher levels of mercury because they eat fish, which also have mercury in them. According to the EPA, the biggest source of mercury is from coal-burning power plants. But that's not the only threat to life in the ocean. The bluefin tuna, which can weigh more than half a ton and measure over 6 feet long, is in danger of extinction because of overfishing. Now, when we say bluefin tuna, we're not talking about Charlie in the can, but rather the tuna that's primarily eaten by the Japanese in the form of sushi. And the Japanese are willing to pay a top price for it. Richard Ellis is a conservationist. He says that kind of demand could be the death knell for this giant fish. Ellis is the author of Tuna, A Love Story. When we spoke a year ago, we asked Richard Ellis to tell us more about this coveted fish.
The bluefin tuna is the world's champion tuna. It's the biggest, fastest, most beautiful, smartest, most highly evolved, probably the most highly evolved fish in the world.
What else about it has made people so passionate about it?
Well, it depends on how you define passion. The people who are passionate about it are mostly the Japanese. And the Japanese regard the belly meat of the bluefin tuna as the most wonderful thing in the entire world to eat.
Is that recent?
Relatively recent. It only dates from the time that the Japanese were able to refrigerate fish in restaurants and in stores. Once they could refrigerate, and that was well after the Second World War, once they could refrigerate it, they were able to store it, and then they were able to produce it as sushi and sashimi, which has, in recent years, made them go crazy.
Well, and tell us more. I mean, obviously, suddenly it's become in favor for a taste factor, but there seems to be something else about this creature, some difference between it and other fish.
They are fast. They are powerful. They are probably, with the possible exception of swordfish, the most widely distributed large fish in the world. There are basically three types. There's the Pacific bluefin, which lives ranges from Japan to California. There's the southern bluefin, which hangs out around Australia and New Zealand. And then there's the North Atlantic bluefin, which is the fish we're talking about, which breeds in the Mediterranean and in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's the North Atlantic bluefin that is in such serious trouble.
Well, explain why. Why?
Well, why is unfortunately relatively easy to explain. They breed in two places, in the Gulf of Mexico and the Mediterranean. The Gulf of Mexico has a lot of ways in and ways out, if you can just imagine what it looks like. The Mediterranean, on the other hand, has only one way in and one way out. And fishermen regard that largely as a custom-made fish trap. They wait for the bluefin tuna that breed there. They wait for them to reach a certain size. Then they catch them, they fatten them in pens, and they kill them and ship them all to Japan.
Well, picking up on something you just said, the fishermen who hunt for the bluefin, which, you know, they travel in packs, the bluefin, they capture them and then grow them further. I mean, explain that, because some would say there are quotas against, you know, taking too much fish out of the sea. There are laws about bluefin.
Well, there are laws against catching too many. There are no laws against rounding up too many. That is the loophole that the fishers in the Mediterranean were able to drive their fishing boats through, because there are no quotas. They're not killing any fish at that point. What they're doing is catching them. They catch them in a big net. They transfer them to another pen. They tow that other pen to a place that's off, another pen that's offshore, and they keep them in that other pen for 6 months, 8 months, feeding them daily until they get big enough and fat enough to kill and ship off to Japan. This happens in every single country in and around the Mediterranean. It happens in Spain, it happens in France, it happens in Tunisia, it happens in Libya, it happens in Egypt, it happens in Greece, it happens in Italy, it happens in Morocco. All these countries are fishing on the same stock of Mediterranean bluefin tuna.
How can that be? Because, you know, if the ban is on catching too many, how can they make the distinction between catching it and taking it away and farming it and raising it and catching it and killing it? I mean, it just seems like the same thing.
Ultimately, it ends up being the same thing. And they can get away with it because fisheries are very, very difficult to police. There's an organization called ICAT, which is the International Convention for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna. They meet every year and they set these quotas out, at which point all the countries that I just named fish illegally and pay no attention to the quotas. They do it. It's illegal. They're making so much money at this that nobody can stop them.
Richard, you know, some have said, what about tuna farming? Now, you quote Columbia University oceanographer John Mara saying fishing in the ocean is no longer sustainable. He proposes aquaculture as a solution not only for the bluefin but for other fish. But we know farm fishing has problems as well, pollution from waste products, fish getting sick and cramped in dirty pens.
Well, there are a lot of problems with it, but it has to be, as John Mara pointed out, it has to be seen as a solution, because we cannot keep taking all the fish out of the ocean and expecting them to replenish themselves. It doesn't work that way. You kill enough of a species and the species becomes extinct.
Well, meanwhile, research is being done into farming the bluefin tuna. You had the opportunity to visit a unique facility in Australia. It was like Fort Knox, pretty strict security. Explain.
It's a facility that has a 790,000-gallon tank in which they were attempting to get male and female bluefin tuna to spawn. What they had done is they had replicated the conditions in which these fish spawn in the Indian Ocean, mm-hmm. north of Australia. And when I was there, they failed. The tuna did not spawn. In March of this year, in March of 2008, they succeeded. They got the bluefin tuna to spawn. They are now raising tiny, I mean, it takes a long time to grow a 700-pound fish. Tuna are born at about the size of a grain of rice, but still they are raising them. And in this lies the potential salvation of the bluefin tuna, because if they can do this, they will be able to sell the tuna at a lower price than the Mediterranean fishers, who have to spend a fortune penning them and feeding them and everything else and chasing them. They might knock the bottom out of the Mediterranean market. If the Mediterraneans can't make all that money, in other words, if the Australians can sell their tuna to the Japanese, the countries in the Mediterranean won't be able to sell their tuna to anybody. They'll go out of business. The tuna then in the Mediterranean will be left alone, and they will breed and live happily ever after.
That's Richard Ellis. His book, Tuna, A Love Story, is now out in paperback. And by the way, famed chef Eric Repair cooked some Australian farm-raised bluefin on David Letterman's show just this month. It caused a minor kerfuffle among foodies who thought it was wild. He stressed it was farmed and thus gave them a little PR boost. Before we go today, Arlington Cemetery. In a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Edward Kennedy will make one last trip to Arlington tomorrow. He'll join his brothers John and Robert on a grassy hillside in the National Cemetery in Virginia. Kennedy is eligible for burial there by virtue of his service in Congress and his 2 years in the military. Philip Bigler is a former historian at Arlington and author of In Honored Glory, Arlington National Cemetery, The Final Post. He's now director of the James Madison Center at James Madison University and joins us from WMRA in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Philip, you remember Ted Kennedy as a frequent visitor to Arlington.
That's right, Robin. I was the historian there from 1983 to 1985, and that actually coincided with the 20th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. You could always be confident that Senator Kennedy would be there on what we considered the anniversary dates, and those were the death dates and birthdays of both of his brothers who were buried at Arlington. Mm-hmm. He would always be there on November 20th, which was Bobby's birthday, and then again 2 days later on November 22nd, which was President Kennedy's assassination date, and even that often would come on Thanksgiving Day. He would even come on Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And then on May 29th, again, President Kennedy's birthday, and then on June 6th, which was Bobby's death date.
Well, and we heard this week from the father of a soldier who died in Iraq that he often went quietly, sometimes at night, with Ted Kennedy to Section 60 to see the grave of his son. Tell us about Section 60. What is that?
Section 60 has become the primary burial area for the people who have died in the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars. So there's a lot of individuals being interred there on a daily basis. Arlington now is conducting anywhere from 25 to 30 funerals per day.
Wow. Well, and this father told us that when in Section 60, Ted Kennedy knew the graves of all the people around his son, that he had been there.
Senator Kennedy, of course, has a great affection for the cemetery, given that both of his brothers were buried there, and, of course, as well as Jackie Kennedy and one of his nephews and one of his nieces being John Kennedy's son and infant daughter.
For listeners who haven't been there, give us a sense of Arlington's landscape. What does it look like?
Well, it's a beautiful area. It was actually the home of Robert E. Lee before the American Civil War, and it is a wonderful rolling area of about 620 or so acres now. It has a wonderful ridgeline that overlooks Washington, D.C., so standing from Arlington House, also sometimes known as the Lee Mansion, you get a beautiful vista of Washington, D.C. It's really a place that you have to visit when you're in Washington. It's a very serene area. Most people generally go, to the Kennedy gravesite, the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. But if you just go 100 yards or so off of the beaten path, I mean, it's like being in a very peaceful park. And in many ways, you get to remember the sacrifice that all of these some 300,000 people have given to this country.
And speaking of sacrifice, the Kennedy grave sites. Describe that part of the cemetery. If you've been there, you know that there's a lot of room, it would seem.
The sites where President Kennedy was buried at and where Bobby were buried at were initially never being planned to be used for a funeral space. So as a result, they have a very openness to them. The graves that they have been very beautifully designed. The Robert F. Kennedy grave site, for instance, is an I.M. Pei design site, the same person who did the Kennedy Library in Boston. The John Kennedy site opened in 1967. The body was reinterred from the first grave, which was a fairly primitive site, mainly because of the fact that there was only a 3-day process between the assassination and the burial. So it took about 2 years before they made this beautiful, beautiful site, which has an elliptical area with the inscriptions from his inaugural address. Of course, the eternal flame, which burns 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And the grave site itself simulates a granite field from Massachusetts, a really beautiful testament to the president.
And there's only one other president buried in Arlington, I understand. So was there some discussion as to whether or not JFK was going to be there, or was it just an automatic?
Actually, there was a lot of thought given to burying him in Brookline, Massachusetts. I mean, that's really where the family plots have been. Actually, now there are 6 Kennedys buried in Brookline. His infant son, who had died in August of 1963, had only lived for 39 hours, had been buried in Brookline. So the first inclination was that they would bury him with Patrick. The decision was made on Saturday by Bobby, Jackie, and actually Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. They wanted the president to be buried in public land, and Arlington was a place that would give the gravesite certainly more access and more visibility to the American people.
Yeah. Well, Ted Kennedy is now going to be buried on Saturday, as was Robert Kennedy. First of all, is that unusual?
It is. The reality of it is Arlington is burying the World War II generation, sadly, right now. There is an enormous number of funerals on a daily basis at Arlington. So as a result, this will make things a little bit easier. Believe it or not, when President Kennedy was buried, there were 22 other funerals that day in Arlington Cemetery. Wow. His was the 23rd.
Well, and you're saying that now there's 25 to 30 a day. And
we
mentioned Robert Kennedy. You say his funeral was the only one at Arlington to take place at night?
The funeral service was conducted at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City, and they brought the remains back with a funeral train, kind of reminiscent of the Lincoln funeral train in 1865. And quite frankly, things were very slow, and it took a long time. There were just millions or thousands of mourners, anyway, lining the tracks from New York to Washington. And so the body did not arrive at the cemetery until after 10 o'clock at night, so they had to set up some spotlights and do it at night.
Well, Philip Bigler, I want to talk about your own personal connections to Arlington. You got married there?
I did. It's always strange when people ask me, and I say I was married in a cemetery, but it was a friend of mine was working at the National Park Service at Arlington House Mansion, and he suggested this would be a beautiful vista for our wedding. So on October 16th, 1982, my wife and I were married on the portico of the Lee Mansion in a beautiful October fall day overlooking Washington, D.C. And then almost remarkably or prophetically, I guess, I became the historian there about a year later in October of 1983. And since then, both of my parents, my father, Charles E. Bigler, who was a Navy aviator, has been buried there, as well as my mother and my in-laws as well.
Well, you know, I don't mean this to be morbid at all, but I'm thinking having a wedding at Arlington means that you have thousands of these silent witnesses in a way.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, we do go there in grief, but we also go there to commemorate, again, this great nation. And so in many ways, for me, it was a great connection to American history.
Yeah. Well, we've spoken about what Arlington looks like. Just remind us, what does it feel like?
On my mother's tombstone, I have the inscription says that each headstone represents a story waiting to be told, a past to be remembered. So when we walk through Arlington, we, I think, become humbled by the incredible sacrifice and the incredible legacy that these people have given our nation. You know, there's a who's who of American history there. But at the same time, there are a lot of the nameless soldiers. You know, you can only gain a sense of awe when you walk through these Civil War sections, and there's over 4,700 unknown soldiers. And all they're remembered by is the inscription simply says, unknown U.S. soldier. So to me, it's a place of inspiration. It's a place of honor. It's a place of dignity. It's certainly the most sacred acreage, I think, in America.
That's Philip Bigler, author of In Honored Glory, Arlington National Cemetery, The Final Post. And the title comes from the inscription on the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington, which reads, Here rests in honored glory an American soldier known but to God. And beginning tomorrow afternoon, Ted Kennedy will join them. Phil Bigler, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.